Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to soon talk about how Ralph Nader changed America, but we can't find our guest at the moment, so we'll just have to figure out what to do. This year, actually, it's hard to believe that this is the 50th anniversary of Unsafe at Any Speed. And so our yet-to-be-found guest this hour took a look at, because he'd worked with him for 10 years, how his work launched the consumer rights, corporate accountability, and other citizen movements. Mark Green has a piece that appears in the December issue of The Nation, and it is titled How Ralph Nader Changed America. It's a very interesting look because the two of them spent a lot of time together. He worked with him from 1970 to 1980, and evidently they would have midnight phone calls virtually every night during that time period, in which he would be filled with information, as Ralph Nader always is. And this was at a time when Mark and his wife were expecting a child, and so Ralph Nader would have looked up some information. So you can only imagine Ralph Nader would have done on prenatal advice, and after the baby is born, he's got the kind of mind that's working on things all the time. So he would call and say, baby watch, and then give his information about what it is they needed to know about having a brand new baby. Well, he's made a huge impact, of course. I'm just filling time here at the moment before hoping that we'll be able to reach him here momentarily. But it is, when you look at all the issues that Ralph Nader worked on and Nader's Raiders, it's included in this article, and let me just mention a few. Cars, nuclear power, pipeline safety, food and drug safety, airline safety, water and air pollution, antitrust enforcement, corporate governance, shareholder democracy, clean energy, tax reform, income and wealth inequality, campaign finance reform, pension rights, old age homes, occupational hazards, healthcare, smoking, freedom of information laws, multinationals, the Educational Testing Service, Veterans Affairs, land management, whistleblowing, a seemingly endless list of vital issues with real-world consequences. So Mark writes, and actually this is an excerpt from what will be a much longer piece. Actually, it'll be a book that Mark will write about, that is being written right now, about Ralph Nader's life. And some of this article looks at his early life and how he, at a very young age, gave indications that this guy was going to have a lot of ideas in his head. And so we hope that we'll be able to locate Mark here in just a moment so we can talk about 50 years of Ralph Nader. And he will look more at the book than he does in this article about his runs for the presidency. He made some Democrats pretty mad. He's made Republicans mad for a long time. But, you know, he made some Democrats mad when he ran for president, and people felt that he took votes away from Al Gore and helped George Bush win the election. But we won't concentrate on anything until we can find the guest. But we won't concentrate on that. We'll look at all of his work and how he came to be the person he is. And he's still at it. He's 81 years old. He does a radio show. He writes tweets all the time. He does a column once a week. And he's still quite active. So 50 years of Ralph Nader, and we hope that that will happen here fairly shortly. Let me just tell you a little bit about what's coming up next week until we can find our guests. We always do this show, in case you are just listening for the first time, Mondays, it's All Things Political, and we have a lot to talk about next week with what's been going on in San Bernardino, California, and we'll look at guns, we'll look at possible terrorism, the presidential race, political reaction to what's been going on there, and also in the Paris climate talks, which have been put on page two because of what's going on in California. So that will be All Things Political, which you always hear for all of you politically interested people, which means just about everybody. That will be the first hour of the show. And then the second hour of the show, I think this is an interesting topic. We're going to be talking about the future of football, and particularly the future of college football, a sport our guest says is on its way to becoming an enterprise where underprivileged young risk their health and well-being for the financial benefit of the wealthy. That, and so we will talk about that. It's pretty interesting topic for us to look at, and that will be Monday at this time, and that will be at 2 o'clock, during our 2 o'clock hour. So first hour, it's all things political, and second hour is we can't find our guest. That's really too bad. I was so set to talk about Ralph Nader. Well, I don't know. We'll just have to see what happens. He starts the article just before we go to what will appear to be an open line. Rose Nader, his mom, in 1938, isn't this a great story, taking her four young children for a visit back to the family homeland of Lebanon in order to meet the Archbishop of the Eastern Orthodox Church. And when it was Ralph's turn to kiss the ring of the Archbishop, he refused and said, "I don't have to kiss your ring. I'm an American." And the Archbishop looked down, patted Ralph's short black hair, and said, "A lot of ideas are going to come from this boy's head." And he was right. So we're going to go to an open line because I've talked enough here. And let's just talk about whatever you would like to talk. We haven't done one of these in years, I don't think. So we can talk about the kinds of issues that you want to have discussed, what you'd like more of, what you'd like less of, a particular great guest you would like to have on, or a book you've read. This is where you provide the wonderful service of being my guest this hour. And maybe we'll find Mark Green and maybe we won't. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And we have lines open for you right now. Let's just talk this, turn this into a discussion of what you'd like to have on the air. And I'm sorry, I don't know where Mark is, but we hope to find him soon and have a future conversation about Ralph Nader. But we do have lines open for you at this very moment. You can also leave comments, which we always like. I really like Facebook. I think you know that. But it's nice to read comments when something has been on the air, and it's really nice to hear your thoughtful ideas about whatever it is we're talking about from day to day. So that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And if you like us, then we can send you material on who will be on the show. It's sometimes really good to know. So you could say, "Oh, yeah, I really want to hear that guest." So that's what you can do. And I just want to let you know, for those of you who heard yesterday's show at 2 o'clock with Tracy Stewart, we did do the hide the dog treat with our dog Murphy last night. And Murphy's an old dog now who learned a new trick. And it was really fun. We must have spent at least half an hour doing the hide the animal dog treat, and it was great fun. I wish we had started it when he was a puppy, but better late, as the saying goes. All right, let's go to phone calls. Sorry, everybody, I was ready for Ralph Nader discussion, but it's all right. You'll be a wonderful substitute. Mike in West Bend, thank you for saving me.
Hey, no problem. I also would like to talk Ralph Nader, but not in this situation.
I know. Okay.
Hey, you know, I've been thinking about some interesting programming things that you guys do, and, you know, I'm really, really a fan of all of the programming. But in particular, I'm interested in possibly featuring more nonprofit or service organizations events that happen throughout the state, such as fundraising events that, you know, the public, if they would appreciate the help of getting public awareness and you know, it kind of feeds back to the idea of supporting your local organizations and things when there's different concerts or bake sales or brat fries or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if we could do that on a website. It'd be hard to do a show on that, Mike, because it's a
certainly
big state. But it's a really interesting idea for putting it on our website somehow. Here's what's going on all over the state, and people could post that. I like that idea.
Yeah, a calendar of events of sort. And, you know, your audience is so broad and vast, and you know, it also seems like the sort of audience that typically supports events like
right
that.
So, yes. All right. Excellent suggestion.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call, and I hope you find your guest.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So do
bye.
I. Bye. Let's go to John in La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, John.
Hey, I'm tuning in here. I'm on the road, actually, driving north to Twin Cities. And the thing that you asked, one of the things is what I'd like to hear. As a conservative guy, I like to listen to NPR radio, but it frequently makes me mad because I don't feel like we get very well represented. But the thing that was on my mind was the Trump phenomena,
mm-hmm,
which it makes me cringe to think that this is our conservative answer here. It's it's really embarrassing. And I'm just trying to figure it out. How is it that there's support? Because most of the people that I talk to that are conservatives like me kind of go, really? For real? This guy could be the candidate? So we go, oh, my God, what happened? Part of it, I think, is maybe I don't really understand it. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand the whole thing. So I'm just kind of throwing it out there as a question more than anything else.
Yeah, I think we've talked about it a little bit, John, but it certainly would be worth an hour of discussion, maybe from several different analysts who could help explain why he appears to be the front runner here. And
yeah.
Yeah. And I know I've talked to a lot of other Republicans who share your concern about him, who say that there's not a possibility he could be elected because he really appeals to a small part of the Republican Party. But to the primary voters, he's what, 25% or 30% of primary voters?
Yeah.
It still doesn't mean he's going to be president, do you think?
I know, but it's a significant number.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. It's just kind of, I don't know whether to just get depressed or just laugh or get mad or I don't know what to do with it.
Well, you must.
So anyway.
All right. Thanks, John. It's a good suggestion, and we'll look for a really good analytical piece about him.
All right. Put a conservative on there, too, right?
Yes. All right.
Thanks
Bye. John. Bye. Carolyn in Superior. Hi.
Hi. A future program. I think I would like to hear something on fusion. There was a program on nuclear energy on NPR this morning, but not too much about fusion. And there's an article in Time magazine, one of their featured articles, one of the November magazines, and all of these developers who are working on this with private monies, and they're saying that within 3 to 4 years he'll have a prototype where he gets more energy out than he's putting in. And all of these others are saying within 10 years they should have a commercial product. There's no pollution with fusion. Something goes wrong with the equipment, it shuts down, and no radiation, whatever. And the byproduct of it is helium. No need to bury the waste.
Uh-huh.
Put it up in balloons.
All right. And where did you see this? It was on in Time?
In Time magazine, one of the November issues.
Okay.
I'm not sure the exact one. Passed it on.
Excellent, Carolyn. We'll look it up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call.
Bye.
Let's go to Steve in Eau Claire. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen. My interest lies in a show that was previously done on last March by Larry Mueller, and I would like to have a current update of that show. It was in March. It was rebroadcast sometime in September.
Mm-hmm.
And it was of real interest to me because my nephew had what was diagnosed as a AVM, arterial vascular malfunction, and had stroke-like symptoms at almost 21 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, he has recovered remarkably. But then 2 months later, his father, my brother, had very similar symptoms, although diagnosed differently. They found a mass in his brain, they found a mass, and it was not cancer. He had a lot of pain. Was diagnosed as an abscess, and they drained it, and he's being treated with similar symptoms because it acts like a stroke also,
uh-huh.
although not related. So, and the University of Wisconsin in Madison, they are doing groundbreaking research on brain healing technology.
Okay.
And that's the major interest I have. I've read Norman Beach's book and found it very interesting, but if we could just focus on Madison, that would be fine with me. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know if they're bringing their product, their tool to market, making it available, or are they undergoing trials? Because I think both my brother and his son, my nephew, might benefit from being part of their trial program. Anyway, I'd just like to know where they're at now.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.
The best to your family. Thanks for your call.
You. Uh-huh. Well, they're both doing real well.
Good. Thanks for your call. Let's go next to Mark in Racine. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Mark.
I'm interested in hearing a show on public banking. A public bank is owned by the public. It's run by the government. It could be a national bank. It could be a state bank. We have one in the U.S. in North Dakota. It's been there since like 1912 or something like that. And a great person, a great authority, if it's possible to get her on the show, is Ellen Brown, who has a website and a book called Web of Debt.
Called what is it called? Web of
Debt, D-E-B-T.
Okay.
Yeah, she's an expert on this. Basically, for example, if you, like in North Dakota, when anytime we want to create more money, we really don't print it anymore. It's created through debt. When we take out a loan from a bank, the bank only needs to have about 10% of that on hand. And there's no legal reason why that can't be done by a government bank. And if we did that, then when people are repaying those loans and paying the interest on those loans, that money can go back to the public.
All right. So where do I find Ellen?
Go online and look for Web of Debt. And I found contact information. She lets me know whenever she's got something new published. She's also on the board of the, I believe it's called the Institute of Public Banking, or the Public Banking Institute,
okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
All righty.
Okie dokie.
Thanks for your interest.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, thanks very much. And we found Mark Green, so we will switch our conversation to Ralph Nader. But thank you. I kind of like doing open lines. We don't do them very much because there's so much to talk about, but we should do them once every couple months because it's good to find out what you're thinking about, and you always offer good suggestions. All right, Ralph Nader. We will talk about Ralph Nader in just a few moments. Mark Green is joining us now. He worked for Ralph Nader in D.C. from 1970 to 1980. His latest story, How Ralph Nader Changed America, is appearing in the December 21st through 28th edition of The Nation. In 1969, Ralph Nader convinced Mark to turn down an offer to be an intern in the office of New York City Mayor John Lindsay and to instead join Nader in Washington. And so he went to Washington, and the two of them worked on all kinds of issues. How Ralph Nader Changed America is the title of the article that appears in the December issue of The Nation. Mark, thanks very much for being with us. Hi.
I'm delighted to be with you. And the reason that you couldn't find me is I had a dedicated line for you to call on at
right.
my home.
Yeah.
Ralph called 10 minutes before. Now, it sounds like this is the dog ate my homework kind of excuse, like I'm making this up.
Right.
But he did. As we talked about the article and other things that he's doing. And so I apologize to your listeners and to you.
All right. That's all right. If it was for Ralph Nader, it's all right. We were all over the place.
My negligence, but that was what happened.
All right. Did he like the article?
Well, let me tell you something. My daughter's a grown-up, 35. She said, Dad, what did the Ralph think of the article?
Mm-hmm.
I said, honey, I don't call him and ask. And nor does he call me and say, oh, I loved it.
Right.
He's on to the next thing. When he wants, he will let me know in the course of our conversations. Because he's not, hey, did you see me on Nightly News last night? He never says that. Well, he told me what he thought of it when I was supposed to be on with you 15 minutes ago. So you're the first. He loved it. It was very flattering. He said there was one typo. I was in Lebanon with my mother in 1937, not 1938.
No. Oh, Ralph. Well, let's start with your daughter then, because she's included in this article as well. When Ralph was on baby watch, and I guess you talked to him every night at midnight for years and years, and he gave you prenatal advice.
Well, you see, people only know of Ralph. Many people only know of him when they see him in the clips or news or history, and where he's quite stern because he's talking about saving lives from bad food to bad cars, you name it. But in fact, he's extremely personally warm and interested.
Hmm.
He treats presidents, waitresses, you and me the same, because he is personally an egalitarian. And while he has no children, he's so loving to his nieces, nephews, and children of his staff. And so he would tell my wife, Denny, when she would pick up in the 1979 when my daughter was born, oh, look, I just found out this and that, and breastfeeding and prenatal care, because he's not only brilliant and visionary and tough, he's empathetic and compassionate.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Let's go back to his early childhood then, and his mom in 1937, not 1938,
yeah.
When his mom takes her four young children, this is a great story, Mark, to the homeland of Lebanon, and there is Ralph Nader meeting the Archbishop of the Eastern Orthodox Church.
Right. Well, the family went back, and Ralph was four, and the family's online to... they're Greek Orthodox, and everybody kisses the ring of the Archbishop. And it's Ralph's turn, and he says, I don't have to kiss your ring. I'm an American. This is a 3.5-4-year-old boy.
I know.
And the Archbishop looks down at him, and according to his older sister, who told me this, who was there in 1937... quote, a lot of good ideas are going to come out of this boy's head.
That's great.
Quote. Now, you got to admit, that's a good way to start an article.
Yeah,
that's true.
It got me right away, I must say, Mark. And there are a lot of other great stories, too.
Oh,
and then he showed that he was going to be driven, in the very best sense of that word, during his early life, too. Not showing up after school because he went to the courthouse to hear cases? Are you serious?
Well, you have to know that Ralph's parents, it was an arranged marriage.
Really?
His father went back to Lebanon to meet Rose. They were married, and then he brought her back to Winsted, Connecticut, where the family home still is. The father, we've read about people like this, is a first-generation immigrant who loves America, takes the Statue of Liberty seriously. He was a flinty, small businessman who believed in community help, love thy neighbor. They ran a restaurant. He wouldn't charge people if they couldn't pay.
Hmm.
And his idealism apparently rubbed off. So when Ralph is 8 years old, his mother would say, where were you this afternoon? He said, I was at the courthouse. I love hearing them argue. Remember, he's not saying this to look good in my article 70 years later.
Right.
And he would read biographies of the muckrakers all the time. Then he would bring home copies of the Congressional Record, which then and now look the same. It's just, you know, page after page of type without a lot of pull quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just, like, grind through it. Now cut to last year there was a dinner of former Nader's Raiders. And a friend of mine sits next to Ralph and says, gee, what are you doing after our dinner tonight? He goes, I'm going home to edit a report, quote, I love to edit reports all night, close quote. Again, he didn't say it expecting it to be repeated to me and then used in my forthcoming memoir and in my article, but that is him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the rest of us.
Right. No, it's not.
Unless you like to edit reports in the middle of
no,
the night.
No, I sure don't. I like to sleep in the middle of the night. You know, I remember interviewing him, Mark. I've interviewed him quite a few times, but I can't remember what year it was. And you write about his parents at the restaurant, their restaurant serving food with a side of civics, which I love that description. But I remember a cookbook that Ralph did that I interviewed him, and I can't find the darn cookbook. I've been looking all over the house.
His mother did.
And then he published it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he thought that up. His mother, I don't know that many Lebanese mothers, but apparently if you're Semitic, you're Semitic. So it sounded to me like a lot of Jewish mothers I know. And so, you know, the kitchen was the center of family life, and she loved cooking for her kids and a lot of healthy hummus-related foods and nuts, et cetera. And so Ralph encouraged her to work with Joan Claybrook. Joan is a close confidant of Ralph, one of the leading auto safety experts in America. She ran the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration under Jimmy Carter. So Joan and Ralph's mother spent weeks working on recipes and published a book. I can't remember the name. Do you know?
I can't remember it. Scotty will look it up for us.
But it's something like, I don't know that her name is even in it. in the title, at least. Something like, you know, home food, whatever. And it's Ralph Nader's mother's recipes. Ralph himself is a big eater, not a big cook.
Which is the way to be. That's I agree with
yeah,
you.
I relate to that.
I do, too. He's kind of all these quirky things that you write about. I had no idea that he did these kinds of things. Periodically, you say he was bored by his courses. He was at Princeton and then at Harvard, and so he would hitchhike around the country, just sort of leave school for a while. What was he doing?
Well, you know, I went to Cornell and then Harvard Law School. Ralph went to Princeton and then Harvard Law School. We're 10 years apart. So I am at Harvard Law School reading, underlining, memorizing, noting, and then taking tests.
Right.
Like, you know, that's all I knew.
Sure.
He goes to Harvard Law School. He goes, what a bunch of crap. They're just turning out assembly line of corporate lawyers. And all I had to do was study the week before. But instead, he went around the country just researching, this is not hypothetical, but literal, Indian rights, status of Puerto Rico, and auto safety. He wrote about them, again, as an unknown student, you know, Ralph Nader, Harvard Law, 1958, for a journal called the Harvard Law Journal, not Law Review, but Law Journal, which was a magazine at the law school.
Right.
And he wrote about this, and so his classmates, I asked one of them, Joe Page, who ended up being a professor at Georgetown Law School, quite prominent, he was a classmate of Ralph's. He said, yeah, he would be gone for days, we wouldn't know where he was.
Huh.
And then he'd come back because he's different. He sees around corners. He is, you didn't ask, but in my, and I know him quite well. I'm like a protege, I admit.
Yes, right.
I said, you know, there are some people who add such value to their line of commerce, to their line of work, that they take it to a different level. So we remember Hearst, Disney, Babe Ruth, Elvis, Brando, Ali, Jobs. And I said, Nader is like that.
Sure.
There were boxers before, but none quite as graceful, who then gave up his career for a few years and risked jail rather than fight in Vietnam. And Ralph is like, I don't know if you or your audience remember Dick Fosbury. Dick Fosbury was a high jumper. And for 2,000 years, from the Olympics until the 60s, people had high jump, men and women, feet first. He came up with the idea of high jumping head first. And now every high jumper jumps head first. And so Ralph, like Fosbury, has always dived head first into high challenges.
And has he ever in so many of them. The book, by the way, is It Happened in the Kitchen, Recipes for Food and Thought, just like restaurant. Nice. So Unsafe at Any Speed, it's hard to believe it was 50 years ago this year, but he got the idea, you indicate in your The Nation piece about him, because he saw auto crashes when he was hitchhiking around the country and decided to sort of investigate the safety of autos.
He told me and many others that he once was in a place where there was an accident, and a young girl's head was almost severed when there was a car crash, a front crash, and the glove compartment popped open, and she happened to hit it at a bad angle. And he did hitchhike all the time. He said he loved hitchhiking, like he loved as a boy, serving customers at the Highland Arms at his home town, because you could just converse with everyday people. You're not just dealing with Ivy League law professors or businessmen or talk show hosts, whatever your line of work, but everybody. And that contributed to his ability to learn and to empathize.
And so the book, which was such a huge deal, and it's, oh my goodness, all that's happened as a result of this. People, how did GM start following him, and what happened as a result of that? They were worried about him, weren't they?
Yes, so it's now 1965. He's published Unsafe at Any Speed. It's doing okay because it's sort of a technical book. It's based on a big premise that big business here, GM, is making a product they know is going to damage, hurt, or kill you, but it's style and profit over safety. And so GM, their general counsel, it later turned out, one of the top 10 people at GM, hired a detective agency to investigate Ralph. They said later when they were caught, oh, we just wanted to see if he was just a malicious person trying to hurt us in plaintiff lawsuits. But what they did is, among other things, they hired two different women on two different occasions to come up to him when he was shopping at different times in his neighborhood store in Washington, D.C. Oh, could you help me move some furniture? Another said, oh, we're having a round table on foreign policy. Would you join us? And Ralph just sensed, like, what is this?
Oh.
He didn't cooperate. Then it was discovered by the Washington Post and the New Republic journalists that, in fact, GM had sent detectives to undercover investigate him. Senator Abe Rivikoff of Connecticut was chairman of a committee that was involved with auto safety, was furious because he was inviting Ralph to testify before his subcommittee. And it's a federal crime to tamper with witnesses. So he called a hearing. He subpoenaed the chairman of General Motors, which is a big deal. And GM then had annual revenues larger than all countries but two, the U.S. and the USSR. So James Roach, the GM CEO, goes and under oath apologizes to this then unknown lawyer who's written a little-known book. And like a Hollywood movie, he goes from being someone on the morning of March 20th, 1966. He goes to the hearing. He's supposed to be the first witness, but he's late because he can't find a cab. You and I might have gotten there early, right? Okay. Can't find a cab. They go with Roach first. Ralph walks into the Senate caucus room, now called the Kennedy caucus room because that's where JFK announced his 1960 presidential campaign. It's the largest room in the Senate. Hundreds of spectators and press. And then Ralph Nader goes up front, and he goes from being an unknown Connecticut lawyer and author to the biggest David Goliath story almost in American politics.
Yes.
Maybe with the exception of Dewey beats Truman. He didn't. And his testimony was, GM, I make one mistake, I'm through. GM makes thousands of mistakes, and they continue. People ask me, why are you doing this, Ralph Nader? Well, if I were selling a product, it wouldn't ask me why. I like saving lives and saving consumers their money. Is that really so strange? And so it was the front page and on TV everywhere. Conclusion, instead of then doing auto safety for 50 years, which would have been completely worthy, he instead invested his fame and the proceeds of a lawsuit against GM into pollution, food safety, educational testing, land use, pension rights, antitrust. The article lists 40 areas Ralph has pioneered in the last 50 years because his goal was not merely auto safety, but making corporations and corporate power more accountable to its stakeholders, consumers, shareholders, employees, communities.
And you say, going back to those phone calls, daily midnight calls for about 10 years, that personally, Mark, he provided the greatest public education of your professional life. What did you talk about all those years, all those phone calls?
Now, your Wisconsin audience, I presume, doesn't know me. But I went on to run and hold the second highest office in New York City, public advocate. I ran for mayor against Michael Bloomberg.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Hmm.
No one else told you that today, right?
Nobody's told me that.
Say, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was a Democratic nominee. I was about to be elected mayor of New York, probably. Then 9/11 happened on the day of the primary. And Michael Bloomberg is a very capable guy. He spent the most money in world history in a campaign, and he wins by 2 points. I mention that because while I've been around advocacy politics and electoral politics, it was all these phone calls where Ralph said, oh, look, this is what I did today. Here's the way I could have responded. What do you think? Here's the way I did respond. What would you have done? Now, mind you, it was like two college friends shooting the breeze, but it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
He was Ralph Nader.
Right.
And I was a young public interest lawyer who had a lot to learn, still do. And I found that when I was in public life later, and New York City is a tough place, it's very wealthy, sort of progressive, very big business, finance, racially oriented. I found that when I ran into problems or challenges, my inner Nader would come out, and I would respond in a way that would reflect his. He was always empirical, Dr. Spock-like, rational. He always brought extraordinary integrity to what he did, and he didn't like to compromise. So I'm no Ralph Nader, but occasionally I would do something that Ralph would have done, and it turned out to be the wrong move politically. when a Bill Clinton, I'm a big admirer of, and friend of Bill Clinton's, when someone of his brilliance and cunning was required, how else did Bill Clinton brain his way to the presidency? I would resort to my brainy advocate mentor, which was morally correct, but politically direct and incorrect. Now I'm responsible for, you know, whatever I did.
Right.
But his sense of tactics, morality, and substance got drilled into me. You know, I would tell anyone listening who's young and just starting out with an internship or a first job out of college or professional school or high school, be careful of your first job and mentor, because it will more likely than not direct you for the rest of your life. That's when we're impressionable and we don't know much and we're picking up. After family, that's what influences you the most.
Hmm. Mark Green is our guest, and we're going to welcome phone calls for him. We have a couple other people who worked with Nader's Raiders who want to talk about Nader on campus, Nader's presidential run, which is a part of the book that Mark is writing, but not the part of the Focus of the Nation article, but I'm sure he's willing to talk about that. 50 years since Unsafe at Any Speed this year, and Mark is the author of The Peace in the Nation, How Ralph Nader Changed America, a look at how his work launched the consumer rights, corporate accountability, and other citizen movements. He spends some time in his article looking at, I want to make sure we mention this and talk about it, some the Congress Project, Who Runs Congress, which took off, he says, like a rocket and remains the best-selling book ever written on Congress. It was a huge book. 1,000 volunteers worked on this book, and they profiled all 484 members of Congress and book-length reports on six major committees. Mark also worked on the first citizen critique ever of federal antitrust law enforcement. Our phone number, we have time for a few phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, Mark, let's go to phone calls for you. And we will start with Dennis in Afton, Minnesota. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, hi everybody. Thanks for the opportunity, and thanks to Ralph Nader for providing the opportunity in the past for me to work with and help form and work for the public interest research groups. It was a very worthwhile time of my life, and I try to keep making worthy days of my life. And so that comes up an idea here. I'd like to share the possible book title. Ralph, if you're listening, please write this book. I could use it this coming summer. Possibly the book title could be On Secure at Any Site. And this is based partly on what I hear over public radio and read here and there. But about a year and a half ago, the director of research for Argonne National Labs in Chicago stated he can get within a half a mile of the voting machines and make the X's go anywhere he wants. Just about 2 months ago, I believe I heard this over Wisconsin Public Radio, in Northern Virginia, they're having a small-scale election, and the machine starts to stop and go. They checked it out, opened up, and the password is ABCDFG, and the election officials up there said we're supposed to have another election like about now, and they said, we don't know what we're going to do.
Hmm.
So, yeah. And you're not going to have politicians talking about this, because that's not a good way to have people be aware of that if they want to manipulate the whole big scenario.
Yeah, send us info on it. We're happy to certainly to look at it. Let's talk about all of those volunteers. And you mentioned in the article these huge projects, this Congress project, which was Who Runs Congress, remains the best-selling book ever written on Congress done by so many volunteers. Something you worked on, the critique of federal antitrust law enforcement. Huge, mammoth projects that were done.
Well, the Congress project is different, related to but different, than the book, Who Runs Congress. The Congress project was 1,000 volunteers, 50 full-time writers, who wrote about every current member at that time and key committees. And when they released their work in October, conservatives were mad because they said, oh, Nader is hostile to us. Some liberals were mad because they assumed that a Ralph Nader project would just praise them, but it wasn't partisan. It was an accountability project.
Mm-hmm.
So, because at that time, pre-internet, only three networks, no cable to speak of, a lot of voters got no information other than from their well-entrenched, well-funded incumbents. Now, the head of Bantam Books at the time, his name was Oscar Distel. And he founded paperbacks in America. In the 40s and 50s, he, you know, came up with the idea of why not cheaper softcover. But it sounds very quaint today in the era of Kindle and Amazon, but he did. So he said to Ralph, you've got to make Congress readable, not just big fat books. And so Ralph asked me and Jim Fallows and an environmentalist named David Zwick to write Who Runs Congress. And Jim Fallows, at the time, was a young journalist. In my opinion now, he's at The Atlantic. He's about the premier journalist.
He's terrific.
In America.
I agree.
He's written amazingly, most recently, about China and the military.
Mm-hmm.
So we write that book, and it becomes number one, and a lot of freshman classes then read it over the years. It's updated three times later because of its popularity. Now, different, everyone understands Congress, and 60% of us vote in the presidential years and 36% in off years. Antitrust law enforcement, if you would introduce and tease this show, and now Mark Green on antitrust law enforcement. Click.
How now, do you know we didn't do that? No, we
I
did. We
not.
Didn't.
And so Ralph said, there was a huge antitrust movement against the big monopolies, which overcharge and underperform. The turn of the century, Teddy Roosevelt, etc. Let's have a new antitrust movement because it's leading to income inequality. It's screwing consumers, and big businesses divide up the markets. So I got a couple of law school classmates, and we interviewed 500 people and produced a 1,200-page report. And we broke up, forgive me, the monopoly that antitrust lawyers and businesses had on this big issue because it affected consumers. One of the people who I did it with, who attacked with me monopolies and what's called oligopolies in America, when two or three companies to control a market, one of my co-authors was Bruce Wasserstein. Bruce died 3 years ago, and he was the biggest rainmaker and master of the universe on Wall Street for 10 years. Bruce ended up running Lazard Frere and founding Wasserstein Perella. And so a lot of the people with Ralph have gone on to extraordinary careers. That's the kind of work we did.
Right.
And the article, and I should say the article is excerpted from a book I'm publishing next May,
mm-hmm.
allow me, is called A Bright Infinite Future, a generational memoir on the rise of progressive patriotism. It's a book how progressive values from the 60s to 16 are taking over in popularity while Obama won twice, while probably Hillary Clinton will win. Forget her skills, pro or con, her individually. There's a big momentum. John Nichols, your local hero, writes best about this in The Nation. And the book argues historically why these trends will lead to a big Democratic.
Hmm. All right, let's go to a couple more phone calls before time runs out. Robin in Duluth. Hi, Robin. Robin, go ahead. Robin, I don't know where you are. Sorry. Scott in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I know time's short, so I'll make this brief as I can. Back in the 70s, I remember, and I think Ralph Nader was instrumental in maybe founding the, they were called PIRG, Public Interest Research Group, and they had, Wisconsin had one, I think it was with PIRG, and I think maybe they're still around. I'd just like to ask Mark about what Nader's role was in that and what kind of involvement he has today in the various PIRGs and what you're active, I mean, how active are they and his role in it?
Nader launched the PIRGs. He came up with the idea that, of course, there's a lot of intellectual and activist energy on campuses. And there's money. That is, every student has a checkoff where, unless they object, they pay a fee to the sports program, to whatever. So he got schools to agree that students would pay as part of their tuition a small fee to hire their own lawyers and advocates to investigate what they want. And if you didn't want to do it, you could opt out. The result, 30 local public interest research groups around the country, 23 still exist, and they lobby for environmental reform, campaign finance reform. And Ralph's view was a person can start a movement, but only an institution can accomplish change. So he created these mini Nader public interest groups, spun them off, and now they're independent. If, by the way, he had tried to control them all over 40 years, it would have failed. But instead, he wanted to be Johnny Appleseed.
Thanks, Scott, very much for the call. When you talk to him, you say in the article he's 81 now, I believe, but he sounds like he's 41.
Well, I spoke to him 10 minutes before you called, which was the delay. And so I spoke to him a lot when he was 41. And subsequently, he sounds as he's completely healthy. He's lean and a Yankee stock, he calls it, coming from Connecticut. And his parents lived to 100.
Ooh.
And, you know, I've known people who in their 90s were very slowed up, obviously, physically and mentally. And then I've known people who in their 90s, Sumner Redstone, who runs Viacom, Sidney Harmon, who was the last owner of Newsweek, in their 90s, they were as sharp as ever.
Sure.
It's just roulette, genetic roulette.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph he never says, wow, remember when we did that in the 70s? He said, we're having a meeting next week to organize the next generation of Nader's Raiders. And that's what we were talking about in a schedule for New York next week.
Remarkable. On it goes. Mark, thanks very much for being with us.
Again, I apologize for the initial foul-up, and I very much am grateful for your time.
Sure. Mark Green worked for Ralph Nader in D.C. from 1970 to 1980 before Mark was elected the public advocate for New York City. He's written a number of books. His upcoming book, Bright Infinite Future, a generational memoir on the rise of progressive patriotism, will be published in May. And he is a contributor to The Nation, where he's written the piece on the 50th anniversary of Unsafe at Any Speed, which is a very interesting look and little-known stories about Ralph Nader. He's also the host, Mark is, of the radio show Both Sides Now. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing the hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're with you again on Monday, next time for All Things Political. And thanks very much for being with us this hour.